try again to study the Talmud in the method of Talmudic analysis, which is a very specific method, and which also opens up, as we go along, you'll see it opens up the verses themselves, and it really teaches you how to study a verse in the Torah. I always say that as much as the Torah always respects creativity, and I always try to uncover new ideas when I learn, but if I don't cut across the paths of the Talmudic scholars, I'm very leery of what I say, because their paths are the main highways of understanding, and if you're on target, you should meet them at certain points. If you don't, anybody could say whatever they want, but how true it is another question. They have to have some kind of verification. The interpretation of Torah, as you know, was given over to Moses, and then the scholars, and the Talmudic method is a very important part of this interpretation. So we're going to go back to the Talmud and to the seven laws. I'll just begin with a little story, which if you people, we did study the Talmud Sanhedrin last winter, and I think that you may be able to answer this question that came up in this incident. My son is studying in law school in Cardozo Law, and in one of his courses he noticed an older fellow, must have been like close to 80, sitting in the class. So he was a little surprised. Most of the people there are young students, and he was very curious about this elderly fellow. So one day went over to him and he said, are you here as a part of the program? So he said no. He said that the professor of this course is my nephew. And he said that I'm really retired. I received my law degree some 40 years ago, and I was practicing all my life, but now I'm retired, and I come here because I just enjoy to listen to my nephew teach the course. He says, I like to go, I'm always intellectually curious, and as a matter of fact, he says, I often attend Talmud classes. And it turns out that this fellow is a law-abiding, practicing, law-abiding Jew, observant Jew, and he enjoys going to Talmud classes. So he says to my son, the Talmud is difficult when it comes to law. So my son asks, why is it difficult? So he says, there are certain laws there that don't make too much sense. So he says, my son said, what? So he said, for instance, if two people kill someone, so they both go free. Okay, now here we have, this is a Talmudic law, and the law states as follows. Let us say there is a rock that is, let me give an example, there's a rock, very heavy rock on top of a building, and one person cannot push the rock over. It requires two people. Now there's a man sitting down by the side of the building, and two people push the rock over the edge, and the rock kills the man. But neither one would be able to do it on his own. So according to the Talmudic law, both go free. Why? Because you can't ascribe the action to any one individual. See, Talmudic law is very exact and very logical. In order for a person to be culpable for the death penalty, he has to be the one that actually did the deed, the action. Now, if he couldn't have done it on his own, he's not culpable. He didn't accomplish it. Each person is a separate entity. Each human being is a separate entity. You can't take two human beings and lump them together and make one human being out of them and say, well, this combination is going to suffer the death penalty. You can't do that because there's no such thing as two people being one. Each individual has to be singularly guilty. So it's a logical problem, and of course, according to pure logic, There is no one individual that is culpable, so they both go free. So this fellow says to my son, he says, well, you see, that's not really logical. And in American law, while in American law, there's a different problem in American law. In American law, there's no inconsistency on a theoretical basis of the law. Originally, they tried to do that. They tried to make laws that are rational and that are logically consistent. But then they found out that it's an impossibility. They can't do it. And they abandoned the theoretical, logical consistency of law for the sake of practicality of law. So today, law is really more of a practical thing. Whether a law is going to be passed or not is more dependent on how it will affect society than at large than upon how just or logical it is. So the criteria for American law are quite different than the criteria for Talmudic law. Talmudic law is completely, the law of the Sanhedrin is completely, must be internally consistent. And if it's not logical, that's it. So no one's guilty. So this fellow told my son, he says, well, you see, the Talmudic approach, which insists on logical consistency in society, doesn't make any sense. How can you let two people go free? So my son said, he said to the fellow, this question has already been raised. And as a matter of fact, he mentioned one of the scholars called the Ran. The Ran is one of the Rishonim. The Rishonim are the medieval scholars, and the medieval scholars, the Rishonim, are really the greatest. They're the basis of our understanding of Talmud, because they combed through the Talmud, brilliant, brilliant men, and you will not find any errors, and practically never in anything they wrote. They had the entire Talmud recorded in their minds, and they were extremely logical and abstract thinkers. So they're really the foundations of our understanding of Talmud. And when you go through, if you go through these, you study the Rishonim properly, they usually bring out every possibility that there is in the Talmud. And they take various opinions, but the important thing is the impossibilities that they bring out. It has hardly happened in centuries that anyone, no matter how bright, was able to come up with something new that the Rishonim hadn't already raised. I mean, it did happen, but it's very, very rare. Very rare. So one of these Rishonim is called the Ran. It's an acronym. His name is Rabbi Nissim. So we abbreviated as Ran. The Ran states, as a matter of fact, he says, when a person studies the Talmudic system of law, he will find that many laws of countries make more sense than the laws of the Sanhedrin. So this fellow got so excited when my son said that. He said, you're the first one that ever admitted to me, that there is a deficiency in the system. And he got so excited, he didn't even wait around to hear the answer to his question. You know, how could it be? I mean, you can't just leave it that way. How could God's law be imperfect? But he was so elated that there was someone that raised the question. He says, then all these people that tell me, they keep on insisting that it's, no, the Talmudic law makes more sense. He says, you see that? They're wrong, and they're just trying to defend themselves. But he says, you're the first one that admitted that there's a problem here. So the next time they got together, he reminded himself that he hadn't really gotten the answer. How is it possible to say that God's law is deficient? God's law cannot be deficient in any way. So then he came back and he asked my son what the answer is. But if you people remember some of our studies over the past winter, I think you should be able to answer this question that this fellow asked. By the way, it is not those who are truly scholars of Talmud never force an answer. We don't force answers. If it doesn't make any sense, we would rather admit that we don't know than to try to force, create an ad hoc answer just to fit the question. We aren't afraid to say we don't know, we don't understand, and we'd rather keep our minds clear and straight than to try to force, like a theologian, just force anything in there, whatever, just to save the religion. We don't have to save God's religion. If we don't understand, we don't understand it. That's it. Good question. Many Rishonim and many of the Talmudic scholars had brilliant questions. Was just left. They didn't understand it. One of the famous ones is how Ezekiel fits in with the sacrifices in the Leviticus. And Talmud says we don't know. That's what it says. When the Messiah comes, he'll explain it to us. We don't know. But the Talmud is always very honest and straightforward, and we don't corrupt our minds in order to. We're not in the press. We don't worry about saving the religion. God doesn't need any help. We don't understand. We don't understand it. But many people feel an obligation to say, no, we're right, you know. So this fellow is an intelligent guy, obviously, and he sensed that they were trying to defend it religiously, and he appreciated the fact that my son said, no, he says, you're right, the question is a good question, it's raised by the Ron, and he says openly that many, if you study many societies, and then you study the Tractate of Sanhedrin, you'll find in certain times, not always, but certain times, you'll say, well, look, it sounds like the law of the land is more just than the law of the and the law of the Torah, like in the case he gave. But the answer is, some of you may know, I don't have a video here, so I can't see if anybody's raising their hands, but if somebody wants to give the answer to this question, I would certainly be more than happy to allow them to have the floor. I can't tell, though. I'll just wait a minute.
Okay. Yes. No one is raising their hand, so...
Okay.
Ray Revis raised his hand, but I don't think he's qualified.
That's okay.
Okay, so you may continue.
Okay. Now, the answer is, you remember, we studied the case of Judah in Genesis. And in the case of Judah in Genesis, we went through why he said that Tamar had to be burnt at the stake. First of all, this is not the kind of death that the Torah prescribes. And she really didn't do anything other than prostitution is not subject to the penalty, to the death penalty. As a matter of fact, prostitution where it is prohibited in Israel, but it's not one of the seven laws. So why should she be subject to the death penalty? So if you remember the way Nachmanides explained this, Nachmanides. And mentioned that Judah was a king in his in the area that he resided. He was a very respected person, and when he moved to that location, he became they made him a king. And there is a law that there is a law that if a person embarrasses the king or does something against the king, so then the king can punish them with a death penalty, even though. It's not part of the system of the seven laws. I'm not interested right now in the case over there with Judah. That's a specific which we went through last time. I'm just using it to bring up the whole concept. And the concept is, it's a concept that exists for B'nai Israel as well as for B'nai Noach. And if you remember when the people asked Samuel for a king, so the people said that they said to Samuel, "And the king, our king, will judge us." That was one of the things that they said. Our king will judge us, and so the Talmud is very careful, and no word in the Tanakh is wasted, and the Talmud states that when the people said that they wanted a king because they wanted him to judge them, so the Talmud says that that is really one of the reasons that a king is, one of the valid reasons that people have a right for a king. So the question, of course, is, I'm trying to find where the verse is, but the question... The question, of course, is why? I mean, why do they have to have a king judge them? If oh, here it is. It's in Samuel 1 Samuel 8:20. It says, "And we will be like the other nations, and our king will judge us, and he will go out before us, and he will wage our wars." So Maimonides states, of course, from the Talmud, that there are two reasons that we appoint the king. One is in order to is for judgment. And to judge the people, and second one is to do battle. Okay, Now, I'm not going to go in right now to the question of what was wrong with their request, because you see that God was angry at them, and Samuel was angry at them for requesting a king. That's a separate thing. But there is a legitimate request for a king, and the legitimacy is expressed in that verse, 1 Samuel 8:20. The two reasons to appoint a king is for judgment and also to wage war. All right. Nachmanides basically, in my opinion, gives the clearest answer, because he says that at that time, God through prophecy was really the one that was giving them advice on waging war. So that's why it was improper at that time to ask for the king. And judgments were done by Samuel. But I'm not interested in that point right now. What I want to bring out, and that is the final halachic conclusion, is that the king is there for judgment, to judge the people. And as you know, the king Messiah judges the people, as is mentioned in Isaiah. That's one of his main attributes, that he judges the people justly. And he'll be, as a matter of fact, he'll be such a great mind that he'll be able to discern immediately who is telling the truth and who is lying, because of his brilliance, like Solomon did. And that's one of the characteristics of the king. So the question, of course, is, what do we need the king to judge if you have already the Sanhedrin? And the answer is that there are two systems of law, that two judgments, two institutions of judgment that exists in the Jewish nation. And one is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a system of law that is purely halachic. It means it is rational, it is perfectly internally consistent. Every point has to work out with every other point. And that's a totally logical system that God gave, and a very intricate and abstract one. Okay, but systems that are so logical and internally correct must of necessity be lacking in the practical. That just is a fact, that it can't be otherwise. That's the way it is. So therefore, what God did was he supplemented the system of the Sanhedrin with the system of the king. The king is really a supplemental system. So let us say, for instance, I was speaking with David about this. Let us say, for instance, in the O.J. Simpson case, okay? So over here, let's say you find circumstantial evidence, 100% conclusive that O.J. committed the murder, if that is the case. Then, according to the Sanhedrin system, you couldn't do anything because you need a witness. But that is a case where the king, if he can prove that the person was a murderer, he would be able to execute him. So therefore, what the king did was, you see, the king didn't interfere with every case. Generally speaking, the Sanhedrin was fine. But the king had to determine when to move in order to keep the entire system just. Like, let us say, for instance, one of the laws by Ben Israel, one of the laws, it was very difficult, as you know, to execute anybody in the Sanhedrin system. One of the things that was necessary before the person committed the crime, he had to have two witnesses warning him not to do it, and that if he does it, he will suffer the death penalty. And not only that, but the person had to respond and say, I don't care, I'm doing it anyways. If he didn't say, I'm doing it anyways, you still couldn't execute him. So see, it was a very strict system which required not just that you didn't kill the man just for the violation, you killed him for the rebellion against the system. That was part of the death penalty, was because of his rebellion against the system. He said, I don't care. So that was necessary. So it was a very strict, rigid system, and many times that wasn't enough. So then the king, he had to assess the political situation, the people, whether it's a state of lawlessness or whatever, where he had to use his wisdom to determine if the Sanhedrin was not enough. There were times where the Sanhedrin could have been fine, because the people, you have to understand that the people of Israel with 613 commandments were, at one time, there were very few murder cases. So, because you're speaking about a system where people are raised with the 613 13, and they're, you know, and they're schooled, and they're studying Torah, and they keep all the commandments. And if they fail, for instance, to put up a sukkah, then the Sanhedrin would force them to do that. It would coerce them. And there were so many laws there that there were times when there were hardly any gross crimes, because the society was functioning so well. But at other times, that's not the case. So this the king has to assess. And the king has a right to, he has a free rein, so to speak, to use his wisdom in establishing justice. So therefore, so that's exactly what my son taught. And this is the same thing, by the way, for the Ben Noach, as we mentioned from the case of Nachmanides with Judah and Tamar. He was instituting the king's law. He wasn't instituting the seven laws of Noah. The seven laws of Noah, which work by a court system, which would be the analog of the Sanhedrin, would be in the case of the Ben Noach. The Ben Noach had the court system, but he also had the kingly system as well. So Judah was functioning as a king. So you see, the God's law is not lacking, and these two systems complement each other. That's why Isaiah says that the King Messiah will judge the people. It means he will do what he sees fit to bring a state of law, law-abiding citizens, and create a society that's conducive to the advancement of knowledge and the good for humanity. So he has to use, that's not the Sanhedrin, he has to use his own intelligence on that. So the Torah very well recognized, but that the Sanhedrin alone is not enough. But the reason for the Sanhedrin is because the Sanhedrin's laws are halachically pure, and we try, and they're logically consistent, and they're very beautifully structured. So we try, insofar as we can, to use that system, because those laws are very perfected in their structure, very exact. But many times, because of the exactness, you can't really, you're going to let a lot of criminals go because of the precise details of the law. So then the king has to step in. But it's important to retain the system of Sanhedrin, because those laws are extremely beautifully formulated. That's God's legal system, and we don't want to throw that away. So we have the two systems functioning simultaneously. One of them is the perfected system of law, and where that fails because of practical reasons, then the kingly system moves in.
So, Rabbi,
yes.
In the example that you gave, could the king, I'm trying to adjust the volume, because people are getting this tape, they just got blowed out. Could the king, in that circumstance, when they knew that one or both of the men killed the guy by pushing the stone, could the king intervene in that situation?
Absolutely.
And rule?
Yes, death penalty. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Good. The king in that situation could move in and could execute the two. In the case where the two killed someone, the king would have a right to move in if he saw fit and execute the two. And the same thing, of course, on a practical level, getting back to the O.J. Simpson case. The king could judge based on circumstantial evidence if he saw fit. If he saw a famous individual that everybody looks up to, and the technicalities of the court would not be able to convict him, yet everyone knows that he's a murderer and he's going free, the king would step in, and in the Ben Noach situation, and would execute the man, because you can't allow flagrant violation of justice to exist in a society without it affecting the entire society. So there the king would definitely move in. On the other hand, the king might not be involved in every little case. You see, he wouldn't be involved in every little case. Would be going according to the same thing with the Ben Noach, would be going according to the courts of the Ben Noach. Now, the courts of the Ben Noach work according to the halacha, so they also are bound by a very strict system. And the king wouldn't step in ordinarily unless he sees fit. He has to assess the society. He has to do things. His objective is to make sure that the society is law abiding. That's his objective. And he has to use his wisdom and his intelligence and his knowledge to do as he sees fit. So there you have that is really the Torah system. On the one hand, we're attached to God's perfect laws.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I want to do three things and see if we got it here. Number one, that what you said, if the two men killed someone, regardless whether they had been Israel or been Noah,
right,
then the Sanhedrin is to find them guilty.
Right. No, the Sanhedrin would not be able to.
Excuse me, the Sanhedrin would find them innocent.
Right.
Then if there was a king in the land,
right,
then the king would have to render the judgment.
But
what if there was a Sanhedrin and no king, then they would be in under the judgment of the hand of God.
And that's it. Exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly
Thank you.
Right. And that's exactly right. There is a time, if there is no king, and there's only the Sanhedrin, then that's true. Then he's under, then the man, the Bible it says that, the Bible says one of the laws is if a man is, let's say the Sanhedrin, for instance, goes through a case thoroughly, and they went through every case very thoroughly, both from the halachic standpoint and from the practical facts. And let us say they made a judgment that someone is innocent. So then they find out a month later they made a mistake. You can't bring him back anymore. Then he comes under God's judgment. There are certain human judgment is fallible, and we recognize that. And there are no claims in the Torah for infallibility. Even Moses, the greatest teacher, made mistakes. Every human being makes mistakes. And the idea of judging, actually the idea of judging another human being, we only do it because it's necessary and it's impossible for society to exist without that. The only real judgment that we respect, of course, is God's judgment. That's the only real judgment. But from a practical standpoint, it's impossible to have a society without judgment, so that's why we have to have the Sanhedrin. But sometimes they're helpless, and they say, well, now he's under God's judgment, as David mentioned. And that is correct. That is correct. There are times like that. If the Sanhedrin tries the case, of course, then the man is free. But the king can intervene and say, just a moment, this is a case. This case comes under my jurisdiction. I feel it is necessary for the society to try this case. And then he could try the case according to his wisdom and his knowledge. And it's not limited by the structural laws of the that the Sanhedrin is limited by. Okay, so that's an important thing. Now that we know there are two there are two systems, so what we're going to do now in studying the seven laws, we must keep in mind that what we are studying here in these seven laws is not the law.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right, we have another question here from Jimmy Carver. Now, Jimmy, state that again. Come here and talk in the phone.
Yeah, this is the, in other words, he said that the king can step in. Can the king step in after the Sanhedrin's ruling?
Okay, the question is, the Sanhedrin gave a ruling. Then can the king step in? And you said, stated, I believe, that after the Sanhedrin is ruled, the king cannot overrule except in a miscarriage of justice. If the Sanhedrin,
yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, once the Sanhedrin rules, that's it. You can't. If the Sanhedrin rules innocent, then the man is innocent. The king can't move on after that. He cannot do anything about it. He has to take.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's stop right here and just turn the tape over while we're right here. Okay, go ahead and explain that, if you will, further.
Okay, you can't have, the two systems can't be conflicting. Two systems are not conflicting. If the Sanhedrin rules that the man is innocent, then the king can't just go over and kill him. That's it. The case was, tried and he was ruled innocent. But the king has a right to intervene, before the Sanhedrin, gets the case, and he has a right to say, this case is coming under my jurisdiction. Alright? So that's the way it works. But they're not conflicting. You know, you can't have a conflict. You can't have one system saying he's innocent and another system saying he's guilty. As though that's impossible. But the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin is determined by the king. In other words, the king can say, look, there's lawlessness now in the country, and we have to try these people. And even though they may be... they may be able to get around the law, the technicalities of the law, we know they're guilty, and we have to do what's necessary. Okay? That's the way it works. So, and that's the concept. If you look in Isaiah 11, that's exactly what when he talks about the King Messiah, he praises the King Messiah because he will be the ultimate, he represents the ultimate, king judge. that will judge justly, fairly, and will take care of the society, and of course, it affects the entire world, that the world should be in a state where there is justice and never a state of lawlessness. That's the problem, by the way, with the, as everybody knows, the problem with American law. In spite of the fact that it's supposed to be so practical, it turns out that it's many times impractical, and you see killers go loose because the system, even though they are not bound, as I said before, the American legal system is not bound by any kind of logical internal structure. It could be illogical, but that's the law in the books, and that's it. They're geared more towards the practical. But nevertheless, we see the flagrant injustices that take place because man is really man is not capable of establishing I'm not saying a perfect law, even a nearly perfect law. But the King Messiah will be one that will establish the most nearly perfect law that that is possible with his wisdom, with his great wisdom. And of course, it doesn't mean only he's not going to be the only one that judges. He will set up a system of others under him that will judge as well and do what is necessary in order to bring lawfulness to the world. And then once the people are in the state where they're receptive to law, then we bring in the technicalities of the technical laws, because that's really the technical laws are the most perfectly structured laws. So we try to minimize as much as we can the law of the king, even though he's a just king. We try to get people to be so law abiding that we don't have to move in to fill in those gaps, so to speak. We hope that when people are on a very high level, there won't be that many gaps, and won't be necessary for the king to move in. But of course, he's always there, and he always has to be on guard. But his function is determined. How much he functions is determined by the society. Okay. So all right. So now what we're going to do is we're going after the seven laws, and
okay. What I want to do is to make the point that in our previous studies that we were taught by the rabbis in the entry level of this B'nai Noach teaching, we're talking several years ago, and a number of people that received those tapes received these tapes. And we were taught at that time, we were not taught this depth, let me put it this way, the depth that we're receiving now, that the B'nai Noach received capital punishment regardless of what happened. Regardless of any of the violations of the seven universal laws. And see, it was not explained in the depth that you are, and I think we need to amplify here that the rabbis, when in the inception,
right,
were teaching what they knew.
Right.
And that this is not a contradiction.
No.
You're not contradicting them, nor are they in contradiction with you, that they merely related the information that they possessed at the time.
Well, they were relegating themselves to one aspect, which is correct, but the...
Go ahead.
...thing is that they didn't introduce the other component. So there is no contradiction between the laws that they stated and between what we're stating here tonight. They were simply relegating themselves to one part of the picture. And I believe, referring to Rabbi Katz, I have a lot of respect for the man, and I believe that he was accurate, no doubt, within that framework, if I'm getting what you're saying right. Except that he didn't go into the other framework, which we're discussing tonight. And, by the way, I mean, this is something which is very common, as I told you. That's why I related to you that incident, that story, because many people in yeshiva, you know, they study the tractate Sanhedrin, and they didn't study the area about the king, you know, so they will only discuss the technically structured laws, and there are different components to the picture. The Talmud is a very, very broad. The Torah is very intricate, elaborate, and all-inclusive. And first you study an area, you know that area, but you have to realize that there are other parts still missing to the puzzle. And To see the whole picture, of course, requires a you know, a truly great. That's what a truly great scholar is. That's like a Rabbi Feinstein or a Rabbi Soloveitchik. He's a man that knows the details of every single component, plus he knows the whole picture. So that's the that's a very high level of scholarship, and it's you know, it's something which is very rare. But the important thing is that if a rabbi teaches, he's not expected to have that level of scholarship. Otherwise, nobody would be qualified to teach. So the rabbi, when he teaches, he is qualified in what he is. That part of the puzzle that he is explaining, he will explain accurately. But you have to realize that, you know, that's not the entire picture. But you can't expect every individual to be a you know, to have the whole picture. Otherwise, you wouldn't have that many teachers. So it would be like mathematics. I mean, the great mathematicians have an overview of the entire field of mathematics. But if you're studying algebra, so you're just studying algebra. But there are many things that you're studying geometry, you're studying Euclidean geometry. There are many things that were introduced later in projective geometry, which really should precede ordinarily Euclidean geometry. So when you study later, you'll see, hey, this stuff I studied before, really I should have viewed from a different standpoint. But that's what knowledge is, you know, that's the way knowledge is in every field, and the same thing applies to Torah. If you're studying one area, you have to realize that there are other components that could change the entire picture of what you're studying now, although what you're studying is correct, given the framework that you're in. So we can't expect you know, anyone to do more than that, than to teach the framework that they're in. And many times, you know, a question comes to me that's outside the framework. When I'm giving a class in Talmud, I say, "Fellas, let me look into this, and I'll get back to you tomorrow." So I have to do research. You know, I mean, the important thing is to try at least to present accurately that which you are presenting, to try for a total picture. You know, at that point. Okay, let me get back to the to what we are doing, and now we're getting into the seven laws. Now, I would only make one preface, and that is that it's something which other people who embrace the Bible, religions that embrace the Bible, like Christianity, for instance. Always had a difficulty. They could never really understand the laws of the Bible. For instance, Leviticus. Now, Leviticus is filled with laws, and that's why basically other religions just threw out those laws, because they don't know how to handle them. You can't understand them unless you have a systematic approach, and the only systematic approach is the one that the Talmud has, and nobody else, you know, if you're going to just start taking these verses and making them whatever you feel, I mean, you know, you're going to come up with thousands of opinions, and it's impossible to understand it. So the point I'm trying to make is this, that the Torah consists of two systems ordinarily as well. There's a system of perfection and philosophy, and then there is the technically structured laws, which are very carefully constructed and very logical. You need both. Because, you see, many people are impressed with the philosophy of Torah. Love your neighbor. Sounds like a great thing. Wonderful thing to do. They might not understand what it means, really, in depth. It doesn't mean what it sounds like on the surface, actually. But it's something which people are enthralled by. Oh, that's great. We'll take that one. But you have to realize that the God system of perfection is a little deeper than that. You can't just grab what sounds good and just abandon the rest of the texts of the five books of Moses. That doesn't make any sense. So what you have to understand is that the five books of Moses, the Torah, really has two systems simultaneously. There is, and as a matter of fact, they break down in a basic way to what the Talmud refers to as the written law and the oral law. The written law is, even though a lot of the written law, you know, when I say that, you have to understand that a lot of the written law is a very important in the oral law, but usually not. The area of sacrifices, for instance, the area of sacrifices, if you read Leviticus, says it has a lot of the structure of the oral law is there. Whereas when you come to Sabbath, it just says don't do any work, and the whole structure of what work means is outside. It's completely oral. Okay, it's completely in the Talmud. But there's a reason for that also, why the Torah sometimes incorporates in the written law things that you would think ordinarily would belong in the systematic structures of the law. But basically the oral law is a reference to the systematic structures, the intricate structures of the law, and the written law usually is the philosophy and the ideas of the Torah. And that's why the Torah is written in a very strange way, because basically the Torah is written, God wrote the Torah in a way that the semantics have to satisfy two systems simultaneously. So you have to know how to unravel the semantics. Just to give you a brief example, for instance, it states in Leviticus that the priest is not permitted to scar himself. Okay. Now we know that's not just a law for a priest, for a Kohen, it's a law for every Jew, and previously it mentions the law, and it doesn't mention the priest. But the reason why the Torah mentioned the priest is here the Torah is trying to satisfy the philosophical, because the priests of the ancient priests, that was part of their ritual practice, was to mutilate their bodies. At certain events. That was part of the religion, part of the ceremoniousness. We even see that today. So the priests would usually be involved in this. So the Torah mentions the priests because it wants to show you that if the priests do that, then the whole system's defiled. So there the Torah is speaking philosophically. So the Torah is satisfying the semantics of the philosophical. And then also, when you read the interpretation of the oral law, you'll find that it's not just the priest, and the reason why it's mentioned is to add another detail to the law. But you have to remember, when you read the Torah, it's written on two levels. It's written on the philosophical, the ideas of perfection, and it's also written on the technical, structured way. Now, the world has some, if you just read the Bible, you get some idea of the philosophical, although probably not an accurate one, because that too requires an in-depth reading, which most people are not capable of, but some kind of idea you'll get of perfection. But when it comes to the laws, most people just abandon it because they just couldn't make heads or tails out of it. But you have to understand that God's system is very, very, very much, very heavy into the laws. Even the prophets mentioned the importance of keeping the laws in Deuteronomy. Anyone that reads Deuteronomy knows immediately that the significance of keeping the laws. The reason is because the God system is a twofold system. A God system is one that demands a certain rigid structure and also philosophy. Philosophy alone is not enough. You have to have the rigid structure. I would say it's similar to the human body. You need the rigid bones to in order to have a human being that's capable of bearing weights, and you must have the structure, and then you have the flesh, the soft part, which is compliant. You see, so you need both. That's the same concept in Torah. You must have the rigid structure, and you must also have the philosophical, which, as a matter of fact, the Torah leaves soft. It leaves it to the individual, because you can't legislate real perfection in man. Perfection in man is something which a person has to get to, and it's very individual. But the structure of the law is extremely important in order that the human being should be brought to the point where he's capable of perfection. So it's a twofold system. There's a rigid structure, and then there is the perfection which is left for the individual. But what we are going to study in the seven laws is the rigid structure. Okay, so I want you just to keep that in mind. And in the rigid structure, as I mentioned before, everything must be internally consistent, perfectly logical, and there's no room here for just arbitrary philosophy. That's not the nature of Talmud. That's why most people look at Talmud, they're looking for philosophy, they get confused. But we'll see as we go along. I think that these points will become more and more clear. Okay, so what we're doing is we're starting off with the Tractate of Sanhedrin, and we're speaking of page 56A, on the bottom of the page. Now, you can get a translation, if you wish, And I know there's one in the manual, and it would be helpful if you would, you know, just read through at least before the class would be the best time to do it. Just to read through and take a look at some of the footnotes, explain a little bit, just to get an idea of what's going on, you know, and then we'll, when we study it together, we'll analyze it a little deeper, and I think you'll appreciate it more if you look through everything first. I would look through till at least till 57A. Get into 57A at least a quarter of the page, and then I think you'll have enough information, and you'll probably read certain things that will just sound astounding to you, which is good, because then when we analyze it and we study it, you'll appreciate it more. It's important that the you know, it says in the in Psalms, Psalms 1, it speaks about the perfect man, and it says, and in his Torah does he meditate day and night. Meditate is a bad word, really. Meditate sounds like something from an Indian philosophy, but it doesn't really mean meditate. It means thinks. In his Torah does he think day and night. Think and work is implied by that word. So he works and thinks in his Torah day and night. Now, the question is, of course, the rabbis are very sensitive to the semantics. Why does it say his Torah he thinks day and night? What do you mean his Torah? The Torah belongs to everybody. It should say, and in the Torah he thinks day and night. But the rabbis explain, no, that little change, that possessive, is there for a reason. It's to teach you an idea that the Torah likes very much a person should be, when he's learning, it should be his own. You're not listening to a lecture. It should be your ideas. You may receive the idea from somebody else, but it has to be yours. How does somebody else's idea become yours? The answer is very simple. If you're bothered by the problem, then the answer is yours. If you're not concerned about the problem, it's not yours. That's somebody else's problem. You see, so it's extremely important when learning Torah to start the process yourself. And I often say, you know, my teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was one of the greatest scholars in the world, probably the greatest when it came to theoretics, he was extremely creative, and, you know, mainly he'd say, of course, his own interpretations. Which were just beautiful. But he would often quote his grandfather, who was really an innovator in Talmudic thought, which he followed that whole system of his grandfather. But there was always a difference between when Rabbi Soloveitchik would say over something from his grandfather, or when I heard another rabbi quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather. Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather was world famous, so it was, you know, people always quoting him. The difference was that when Rabbi Soloveitchik would quote him, he wasn't quoting somebody else. It was his own Torah. He was there. It could be, certainly his grandfather was the one that may have come up with the insight, but Rabbi Soloveitchik wasn't parroting over something. It was his own Torah. He was there. The question was bothering him, and he saw the solution, and that really is what Torah is all about. Studying Torah is not listening to a lecture. The world today, the academic world today, the collegiate world, has no concept of what Torah learning is. And in my opinion, they're lacking the whole concept of learning in general. But in the Talmudic idea of learning is not listening to a lecture, it's not taking notes, it's not repeating facts. It is an involvement, an engagement of the mind on an individual level. And therefore, if a person just sits back and takes notes like a college course, he may pass tests, but the purpose of the Torah is not to pass a test. The purpose of the Torah is to have knowledge that's related to your personality. That's your Torah. So therefore, I say it's a very good idea to read through the Talmud before, even if you don't understand it, even if it makes no sense to you whatsoever. That's good, because then you're going to have problems, and if you have problems, they're going to be your problems, so then when we come across the solutions, it'll be your solution as well. Okay, and maybe you'll even come up with a solution. So, not just the teacher comes up with solutions. That was a story in the Bible with Moses and the daughters of Tzolofchad, if you remember. They raised a question about inheritance. Moses didn't know the answer. They had their solution. And Moses went to God, and what did God say? Yes, correct. The daughters of Tzolofchad are speaking correctly. So you see that the great Moses, who was the great teacher, he was wrong in this case, and the daughters of Selefchad were right. So in the Torah, there's no ranks. It's not a system of ranks. You could be the greatest scholar, but you can have an oversight, and someone who is far less learned than you are can come up with the right solution. So Torah, in that sense, Torah is very democratic. Therefore, I say it's important for you to put your minds to it as well. All right. With that introduction, let us begin what the Talmud states. And Talmud Elias, the rabbis have stated, now the Talmud states what their comment was. And this is the comment, quote, seven laws were commanded to the sons of Noah, all right? One of them, first one is courts, legal system. They must have a legal system. Make sure it has a legal system. Second one is blasphemy. The order is not important. Third one is idolatry. Fourth one is sexual prohibitions. The fifth one is the law against murder. And murder is the right word, not against killing. And people that translate the Bible and say, thou shalt not kill, it's an inaccurate translation because it's not true, because the Sanhedrin, openly in the Bible, God said to kill the violator. The one who violated the Sabbath, Moses received the commandment of how to kill him. We just studied, if you remember last winter, that God stated that the death penalty is the proper penalty for blasphemy. It wasn't known. Moses didn't know. So, thou shalt not kill is inaccurate. Thou shalt not murder. Murder is an act of violence of an individual in a society against his neighbor. But when a court, when a legal system kills somebody, it's not murder. They're not doing it because of their own individual reasons. They're doing it in order to instill justice. It's an act of the court. That's not called murder, although it may be called killing. And I think Christians always misunderstood that commandment when they interpreted and translated it as thou shalt not kill. I one time mentioned it, and I went to a Jesuit college, and I one time mentioned it, and the professor simply didn't believe I was correct. I happened to know the Hebrew. The Hebrew is lo sirtzach. Sirtzach means murder. Saharog would mean kill. So it's two different words in Hebrew. Based upon that, the Christians have often introduced a kind of clemency, and where the Torah really does not maintain that clemency is justified. Sometimes the death penalty is necessary, and not to impose the death penalty is to allow people that are lawless to run the society and to destroy the entire society. I mean, the Bible mentions openly when it comes to murder, do not accept any bribery. And if you do that, you're going to destroy the land. And as Nachmanides brilliantly states, he says, the compassion of the fools destroys a society. And that's what the Torah is, that's what the Bible is against. The compassion is a wonderful, wonderful trait, the most wonderful trait. But it must be guided by intelligence, and if it's not, then it's the compassion of fools, and you will simply destroy the entire society. So over here, when we say this case, it means murder is prohibited, not killing. Killing is taking a life. Sometimes that's necessary. Okay, next one. Excuse me. Next one is theft, and then we have the law of the prohibition against eating the limb of an animal that was taken from the animal during its lifetime. Now, this doesn't mean simply that you're not allowed to go over to an animal and remove a limb. It's more than that. Even if the animal lost the limb itself during its lifetime, when it was alive, just dropped the limb, you are not permitted to eat that limb. Okay, that is the law. Now, again, over here, we're getting into, here's where we have to differentiate between philosophy and between halacha. Philosophically, you can give reasons, you can say kindness to animals, whatever you like, but that plays no role when we come to the rigid structure of halacha. The only way we know the structure of halacha is from the scholars that go back to Moses at Sinai, and philosophy is nice, it's good, it's necessary even, but it doesn't determine the law. The structure of the law is very, very exact. And the structure of this law is not simply cruelty, because if an animal lost a limb by itself, on its own, during its lifetime, you still would be prohibited from eating that limb. You would certainly be prohibited from eating a limb if you ripped it off during its lifetime, but that would be, in halacha, they would both be equal, whereas one would be a vicious act and more.
We have one minute.
Okay. So even though one would be more condemnable, but nevertheless, in terms of the violation of eating, they're both equal. That is the structure of the law. The structure of the law is not to eat a limb that was lost, removed from an animal, by whatever means, during its lifetime. Okay? The philosophy and the structure of the law are not, and this is important, they are not commensurate. It's a different kind of a system, because the halacha has to be logically structured, and philosophy is not logically structured. It's not structured. It's a concept. So don't be upset if the case of the law may be more inclusive than the reason for the law. That doesn't matter. That's because of the fact that you must have a structure to the law. And this is the structure that the law takes. Why it takes this structure rather than another structure, that, as we will be able to discover that, and that's an area of discovery on its own, but in a very special way, as we will go along, we'll see how that works. But you have to drop philosophy. Okay, I guess we're running out of time.